When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, welcome to a special edition of the Book Riot Podcast, which is a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and we're talking about in the world of books and reading. This is our annual year in review show, episode 344. Today is Thursday, December 19th, 2019. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from the tail end of 2019. From bookriot.com. Rebecca, it's been a
heck of a year. It's, you know, it has flown by and been filled with all kinds of happenings. So I'm looking forward to reviewing some of the things that happened this year. It didn't seem like that wild of a year in publishing. And then I went back through a year's worth of our trusty podcast agenda document that's now like 700 pages long.
And it always feels that way. Like, yeah, there's not going to be much. Like, oh, wait, that happened. Oh, wait, that happened too? I can't believe it. Before we get to specific stories, was there a big picture? Is there any big picture interesting stuff? Like, where are we? We sometimes ask this question, where are we in the world of books reading? I think the last couple of years we sort of said we're steady as she going it a little bit. And in the macro sense, it feels like books are kind of how books have been for the last couple of years on a macro scale.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't feel like there were any big shakeups this year, no big changes or developments. Like nobody launched. It wasn't like the year that Scribd and Oyster launched and we were going to try out all you can eat reading apps or anything like that. And also no major crises in terms of like the health of the industry itself. It does feel like steady as she goes. And as we get into one of our big stories of the year, I think there's some potential for the next couple years to be really interesting, but I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the big story? What is the biggest story of the year? Is there the most important book-related story of the year? We don't have that. You have the biggest story that wasn't, but then it turned into something that was, but that did not conversely then become the biggest story of the year, which I found interesting.
I thought it was going to be the biggest story of the year. It was that Barnes & Noble is selling. And there were definitely some shenanigans around that, you know, like the rumors that they had that they had made a deal, but then they backed out because of stuff that was going on at the corporate level and inappropriate behavior of some kind. And then Elliott Advisors came in, Barnes & Noble accepted the offer. And it sounds like some things are starting to change at Barnes & Noble, but there haven't been any radical shifts. And, you know, Barnes & Noble didn't close a jillion stores. They also haven't announced that they're going to open a whole bunch of new things yet. It's like, this is a big deal that Barnes & Noble has sold, but it hasn't caused, there have not been big effects of that big deal. I honestly did not feel like there was a big publishing story of the year. There were several notable things that we'll get to.
Yeah, in a macro way, things that will actually affect the underpinnings, pillars of the earth, Ken Follett kinds of foundational transformations. If Barnes & Noble had gone out of business, that would have been a big deal. If it would have been sold to an Amazon or one of those, it would have been a big deal. If it would have been sold to someone who immediately came out with a big, bold new vision for Barnes & Noble, that would have been a big deal. But being sold to, you know, a British book chain, which is kind of seems to have a steady as we go kind of mindset, is basically the status quo is in place, which is not nothing, but it's also not super exciting or earth shattering. And I think for those of sometimes I'm in this camp, sometimes I'm not. It sort of depends. Wondering about how much of a bulwark Barnes & Noble actually does serve against something bad happening to what we like about books and reading. I guess this is the minimum viable happiness outcome. It's like they're still around. They're run by a bookstore. They're going to be kind of doing what they want to think. On the other hand, I was hoping for innovation. Yeah. Maybe we'll see that. I don't know. So I can see why it's both the biggest story and also kind of, we'll see.
Minimum viable bulwark, I think, is the way to the way to think about it. That, and maybe there will be innovation. I would have liked to see some innovation. But yeah, there just wasn't a lot of, like, you know, James what is his name? The head of Elliott Advisors, the guy who's running. Yeah.
Oh, right.
The guy who's running Elliott Advisors. He didn't, or who was running Barnes and Noble for Elliott Advisors. He didn't like roll in and clean house and have a bunch of new initiatives straight out of the gate. Mm-hmm. So it will just remain to be determined.
James Daunt. Daunt
I was I like, believe. Blunt is not right. That's the singer.
Yeah. Okay. That would be interesting if James Blunt had bought.
Or Emily Barnes Blunt. Emily Blunt and John Krasinski buy Barnes and Noble.
Now you got it. Now we're cooking. I guess the only other one, and our next episode is going to be with Amanda Nelson's going to join us, the books that captured the decade in books and reading, which we'll talk a little bit more there. And one thing we might end up talking about there, it's at least on my long list of things to talk about possibly, is the drumbeat of Trump books, the fears, the Fire and Furies, the Comeys. That was another trend. I'm not sure it added up to anything.
I don't think it did. I thought about putting some of those Trump books on this list, but nothing really became of it. And it's interesting to be recording this on the day after the impeachment vote and thinking about that there were all of these books that contained material that could have lent to that outcome. But ultimately, none of the revelations and any of those things seemed to make any difference. So that I think that's also a big story that wasn't. They sold well, like Fire and Fury sold well, Fear sold very well, but they didn't have a cultural impact or touch the political landscape in a meaningful way.
And you and I have compared them as they've come out to, you know, the All the President's Men being the touchstone, right? Like here's the example of the one that will endure over time. The thing is, we're still in the middle of this Trump story, whatever it's going to be. He hasn't resigned. He hasn't been, you know, voted out of office. He hasn't served out his second term. He hasn't burst into a big flaming bag of McDonald's French fries. Like none of the, we're still in the middle of this. So until we're done and someone can write the big book or the book that actually does break the increasingly orange camel's back, they're all kind of in process documents, right? Like this is like the middle books in a series. It's not the beginning. It's not the end. They sell. People are interested as they go. But they're not going to be the totems that I think we're going to carry into the future until one of them is the thing that makes the change or is the chronicle of what the hell actually just happened here. So maybe at some point we'll get that book, I hope sooner rather than later for a variety of reasons and political affiliations. But I think that's a thing that's going to continue until it's done and it's just in the middle for now. Let's do a sponsor and then we'll come back and get some actual stories.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
All right, so the biggest story that wasn't, if you would have told us that Barnes & Noble sold this year, we'd say that is for sure the most interesting story, and it kind of was. Turkeys of the year, I think two of them are related, and one of them is a different trend. So we have three on here. Mine's a question mark that I added on. Of the turkeys, our three finalists are the Nobel Prize is double, where we also recognize a genocide apologist. Sorry guys, we read some conspiracy theory books that we didn't do our homework on. The Booker tying itself into knots with a tie to award both Margaret Atwood and Bernardine Evaristo's to share the Booker Prize. And then Macmillan shooting itself in the foot in libraries as innocent bystanders and a lot of our time and attention. Of those three, do you have a front turkey?
A front turkey. I think the Macmillan ebooks embargo is the most important of these turkeys because it touches libraries, and libraries touch readers' access to material. And this was just really hot button, and I think ignited and amplified conversations that librarians had been having around ebook purchasing and pricing and lending, but brought them out in a bigger way. And some of those libraries, as we saw, even did write letters to their patrons. So this conversation went beyond just the literary and the publishing community. I think that's the most important one. The Nobel Prize one, I think, is the biggest in like that. That is the biggest turkey, just because it's been so there are it's turkeys all the way down that there were issues before. So they didn't give a prize in 2018. Then they finally come back. They give the double prize, but one of the prizes is to a genocide apologist. It's about conspiracy theories. Now there are people leaving the Nobel Prize committee, as we were discussing last week, who went in to help make the changes to try to improve things. And they were like, this is taking too long, y'all. We're out. It's just been kind of a facepalm situation for years now, watching what's going on with the Nobel. And the Booker was just a like, man, you really didn't think about how this was going to land. I think the Booker Prize is really, that's an unfortunate decision.
More of a bad look. It's a
bad look. Unintentional negative impact, I think, from that decision.
Right.
Just a failure to have the perspective or imagine what public response was going to be. But the Nobel Prize stuff, there's just kind of no excuse for how many turkeys are loose over there. I'm going to go with, I think, the Macmillan eBooks stuff and the broader thing going on in publishing with trying to figure out what do we do with digital lending through libraries in a way that serves the library's needs and patrons' needs, but also allows publishers to make whatever they need to make for it to be sustainable. Like, that is a problem, an actual problem to be solved that impacts readers. And so I care about that one the most.
Yeah, I care about that one the most. And we on this show, or I'll speak for myself, have been, I'm more sympathetic to Macmillan than many I've seen online. I don't know that I would sign lock, stock, and barrel with what they want to do. But my own digital lending habits have changed to such a degree that I sort of can recognize from my own use case that there's something different going on here. Like, I was looking at my year in reading and I track where I read stuff from. There's a lot of Libbys, a lot of Libbys, and a lot fewer Amazons, Powells, Apple Books than there have as a percentage. If I'm at all representative, that portends a major change. And the difference in digital lending versus print lending, we don't have to go on all the differences here, but from my point of view, the ease of checking out and returning means that my own personal turnover is way higher than it used to be, way higher than it would be if it was just print books. And what that means for libraries and publishing, I think, is an open question still. And Macmillan tried to answer it, and I can sort of see where they were coming from, but it did not go like they wanted to go. And I think the messaging has been tone deaf, to put it charitably. I think they haven't had anyone come out, any other publisher come out and want to sort of say, I'm a turkey too with them. So they've been a little bit hung out to dry. I'm not sure what the future is, because it is the only reason to buy something from a Kindle versus get it from Libby is speed. And it's just as easy on your phone. You don't have to drive to anywhere. And we talked to Mike Schatzkin for an episode of Annotated, and the great competition in bookselling has been who can get the right book to the right person at the right time the fastest. And Libby is now as fast as Kindle, save for hold times. And the only way to lengthen hold times is reduce the number of copies or jack up the prices. And Macmillan has done a little bit of both over time. I don't know what the way forward is here. I don't know that the current status quo can exist. I don't think Macmillan's model the public is going to be happy with. I don't know the way out here. So this one's going to continue to gobble. That's my take on this particular turkey. I don't know. The Booker next year could give a prize to someone that we're all like, oh, that makes sense. The Nobel Prize, it's like nine people in a room. Like, theoretically, they could shoot it. The Macmillan thing is a systemic problem.
Yeah.
And or at least Macmillan's presenting as a problem. Whether it's an actual problem, I guess, is a thing. But that's a systemic thing, and the changes, it's a pillar that's being moved around in the way that people read, and that matters. That really does.
I like it's going to continue to gobble.
Yeah, unfortunately. I would like a situation where publishers and authors can still make money and produce the books I like to read, and libraries can provide service to their patrons in a way they feel good about. Right now, it's hard to see how both of those things work under the current model. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, it definitely remains to be determined. Now. It'll be interesting to see where we are at the end of 2020 doing this show and what's happened. It feels like there's potential for this story to be different over the next year.
Let's look into your crystal ball.
Ah.
We're at the end of 2020. Who has blinked in the Macmillan library ebook situation? Who's changed? Have libraries and the public sort of swallowed it? Has Macmillan blinked? What has changed? If something has changed this time next year about this story, what do you think will have changed?
I hate to say it, but I think I actually don't think anybody's going to blink and like publicly throw their hands up and give in. But it seems like the momentum around the library response has really slowed. And I don't know if that's just that it's the holidays and there are other things to pay attention to. And also the president's getting impeached and there's just other, there's just others.
Not much oxygen left
right,
in the room.
Like there's just
that.
Other stuff going on. So maybe we come back after the first of the year and more library systems are starting to mobilize around this. I think if that happens, Macmillan may very well decide that they need to do something back down in some way. But if it stays as quiet as it is right now on December 19th, I don't think Macmillan is going to have to make any changes, and libraries will either just continue to not buy Macmillan ebooks or will quietly blink and start repurchasing.
Yeah. That's interesting.
It seems like it's really quieted down, which is a little bit of a bummer, but also it could come back. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, if you're Macmillan, I guess what do you hope? If you're Macmillan, you hope libraries find it painful enough on their reader services side that they have to buy Macmillan ebooks again, right?
Yeah.
Your worst case for Macmillan, I guess, is librarians find, you know what, we can service our clients fine without Macmillan titles.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which could happen.
There
are a lot of books in the world.
And that speaks to our question about, if publishers had it their way, would they have to service libraries at all? Like in their heart of hearts, do they want to be in the business of providing books to libraries that people can check out for no additional cost? Not free. I know it's not free because of taxes. But it doesn't cost me anything additionally than the tax I've already paid to read 10 books on Libby. Would they rather me have to go out and buy the Macmillan books I want to hear about? How much are libraries really a portal of discovery that builds value over time? That's the things librarians say. And I could believe that it's true, but I also could believe it's not true. We just don't have any data either way.
Speaking of libraries, my favorite trend of the year, we're seeing more of this in the last couple of months, is libraries eliminating their late fees and overdue fines, especially for kids. But many library systems have just eliminated them wholesale. And I love that.
Talk about picking up steam.
Mm-hmm.
We saw several dominoes, large metropolitan dominoes fall in a row, really hard upon each other, where it didn't seem like there must have even been much internal debate as quickly as it happened, or it's been going on and simmering for a while. But Chicago and Memphis and San Francisco all seem to fall in line in relatively short order, and Boston Public Library and many others. It feels overdue, pardon the pun, for this to happen. I recently got my own kids their own library cards, and there are no late fees associated with them here in Portland. And basically, you can't just check out more books if you've got stuff overdue. You have to bring them back. You don't have to fork over $8, $10, $12 in addition to bringing the books back. So you have incentive to bring them back. It seems to me like a win largely all the way around. There might be some revenue shortfalls. That doesn't seem like it on the whole between collection development, people keeping the books because there's no incentive to bring them back if they can't pay the fine, and just the cost of collecting fines itself is onerous. And frankly, libraries don't want to be in the business of being bill collectors.
Right.
And I can totally understand that's not what they signed up for. They want to be servicing their patrons and doing the best they can, not shaking 8-year-olds down for $6. So I think this is something that we're all glad about. And a vestige, I wonder if we invented the public library now, if late fees would be even a thing we would think about doing. Hmm. It does feel like a vestige of a former time of public services.
Yeah, I agree. I think that having other consequences in place, like if you have overdue materials, you can't take out new books, that makes sense. But charging money, like when you really step back and think about the purpose of a public library and the patron who is least likely to be able to pay their late fee is the same patron that most needs the services of the library to access information and material, that like if a $4 late fee or a $20 late fee or whatever it is preventing you from being able to like take the thing back to the library, get the materials you need, you're likely the kind of customer, the kind of patron who needs the library and isn't going to be getting their information by buying books, or may not have internet access at home, might need to use the services at the public library. So if the library exists as a public good to serve those patrons, then tying it up with a person's economic status really does not make sense. I would like to think that if we invented the public library today, we would have other social contracts around late and overdue or lost material that would not prevent someone from continuing to use the library if they couldn't pay in some way.
It does seem, in our modern understanding of privilege and pay and marginalization, that this is not how we would design
right.
it. But
yeah.
Maybe I'm giving us too much credit. Speaking of bilking the people who could get the most out of reading and can at least afford to pay, that's the inverse of one of our least favorite trends of the year. We got three, trilogy of evil here. The ongoing policing bans, metering, charging people in prison to access books, restricting their access to book, using suspect security, quote unquote, guidelines to keep books out of people's hands who are in jail. We hate this. We don't like this to happen. Has anyone ever heard of a story of like someone doing something nefarious in jail because they were inspired by Anne of Green Gables or something like this? I've never heard of it. I'd be surprised if we ever did. But something that seems to have picked up some momentum and finding prisoners and books as a revenue stream for prisons needs to go away. Keeping books out of the hands of kids where the books have LGBTQ+ themes also is bad. I hate the trend also of the stealth, as you say, stealthy attempts by unnamed sources, secret meetings, anonymous complaints, those kinds of things.
It didn't
cowards
meet our
policies,
and the policies aren't published anywhere.
Right, yeah. And the mechanism for publishing the policies or saying or reviewing who reviews the reviewers
right.
Here is very much a thing that's happened. The waterfall down of resistance to inclusive books hitting the final couple rungs where they can in public schools and public library systems. I hope this is just a dead cat bounce, and eventually this too will go away. But we need to comment it on here. And also, related to that, people protesting Drag Queen Story Hours, having events canceled, having them moved into different places, that picked up steam in a way I didn't foresee. We heard earlier stories. We did a story on Annotated about Drag Queen Story Hour and initial protests, and it seemed like we'd gotten over the initial resistance to the idea, but I was dead wrong. And maybe it's my position of where I read these stories from. I was surprised to see that not only did opposition continue, but increased and got more vocal and more physical. And a lot of these programs have shut down because it's exhausting and dangerous and disheartening to have this much resistance to something that is an aggregate good. On the whole. So I feel saddest about that because it felt so pure, I guess, at the beginning. And to see it turned around feels like a real step backward.
Yeah, I agree. That one is the one that hurts the most in the overall like elements of the story, that you've got kids getting a chance to just do something as fun as go to a drag queen story hour with the built-in exposure to people that they may not have ever seen before, or a kid who's sitting there thinking, that looks like fun to me, and I didn't know that was an option that's available in my life, and now they know that is a valid identity and a valid way to express yourself. That's a really powerful thing to expose kids to. And that's why people are upset about it.
Yeah.
Of course, people who are afraid of these things are upset about it. The other stuff I think is disappointing, but in predictable grossly human ways of, you know, trying to profit the prison stuff, like trying to profit off of people who are literally disenfranchised. And then the use of like political power and privilege in academic situations to like just stealthily try to remove LGBTQ books from kids' shelves. Really predictable, really disappointing stuff, but not as heartstringy. Certainly, yeah. All of these are very important. Like, don't send me a letter about how I'm not upset about any of these. I'm very upset about all of them. But the Drag Queen Story Hour one just really was like, do we seriously, like, this is what we're going to do as humans in 2019? I would love to not hear anything else about any of these stories. And the prisons, the stuff in prisons and the LGBTQ books, like, these are not stories that started in 2019.
No.
These are problems that the public and the reading public has had for a long time, but they seemed to really increase, or maybe just the attention that we've been paying to them increased in 2019. And I'm glad to have that coming up in the public dialogue so that action can be taken around it. I guess that's the silver lining there, is that the more aware we are of these kinds of things, the more opportunity that we have to try to do something about it.
And there's something too, I mean, you're right. Like, in terms of actual import, I don't know that we want to parse one versus the other. That's not what we're trying to do. But there, I think part of the Drag Queen Story Hour being so sad to me is, you know, how jubilant drag can be, and in this situation is, and people putting their bodies on the line,
yeah,
and going into libraries and taking a risk and taking a chance. And then seeing when it's gone well in places, how well it's gone, how much the kids have enjoyed it. What a symbol of inclusion it is. And I think the human cost is just easier to see than with these structural ones. Mm-hmm. You know, and I interviewed some people for Annotated that were doing Drag Queen Story Hour, so I feel closer to it personally than some of the others. I don't know. To see people in drag reading to kids, having a great time, and then seeing people with hateful signs outside of it, it just hits you hard. It really does. The visuals just hit especially hard. Things we like to see more of, we can maybe get through this one quickly. This is a Rebecca one, so why don't you tell us about this one we'll see more of.
Yeah, a couple months ago we saw that Patagonia was going to go 100% digital with galleys of their upcoming books. Patagonia publishes some books, and they are no longer going to do printed galleys, paper galleys. And I was excited about that. I think you and I are both fans of how Patagonia runs its business, or at least very interested bystanders in what Patagonia is doing as a corporation and how Yvonne Chouinard has built that. They've always had a focus on giving back and also on trying to run a business in as positive or at least non-damaging a way as possible for the planet. As a person who gets like literally hundreds of galleys in the mail, thousands over the course of a year, more than 100 in a month, delivered to my door, and most of them get recycled or donated, I would love to see more publishers go 100% digital with their galleys, or at least really significantly decrease paper galleys. Like, make us request it if we want a printed one. It's just so many trees, and then so much water usage, and so like the carbon footprint of producing paper galleys has to be bananas, and it, I don't think, is really justifiable at this point with the technology that we have. I would love to see more publishers go that way.
Yeah, that's another one, kind of like the library finds. Like, if we were creating the world anew and we were trying to get review text in front of people, I don't think today would be like, you know, we should print these out and send them, shotgun them out into the world with, you know, little to no guarantee that they're getting to the right person. I've been reading a bunch of year-end stuff, and there's been quite a bit of talk about, like, this is the year that climate change trended, in a real way. And we see a piece from time to time about the environmental impact of publishing and printing books. I do wonder if there's a climate moment coming for print. I don't know that much about the environmental impact of where my printed books come from. But in the grand accounting that we seem to be doing, and are we sure we want to do it this way? Is this sustainable? What are publishers' practices around using sustainable sources for paper and printing and ink and energy and all the things we care about when we talk about making anything? Our hamburger gets a lot more scrutiny than my hardback. Is that good? Is that fine? Or is it not fine? I am curious about this. And this is one crack in that maybe wider story of like, is it good to print a book? I don't know. Speaking of things we'd also like to see data for, celebrity book clubs sell books, shruggy emoji to the sky. Sure, we want this to... I didn't think to put this on here. I'm so glad you did. Do we want it to be true? Let's say you got to change the universe, like in Avengers Endgame. You pull one stone out and like, do we want it to be true that celebrity book clubs sell books, or would we rather it be true that some books just sell for organic word of mouth reasons? Which of those two worlds do we prefer? Is that a weird question?
It's an interesting question.
Or does it not matter? Maybe it doesn't matter.
I think it ultimately doesn't matter because I think celebrity book clubs are like morally and ethically neutral as a concept. But many of the, maybe not many, some of the celebrities getting the most attention for their book clubs are seemingly giving like mindful attention to the kinds of titles they select, or at least to being diverse and inclusive in the titles that they select. And so in that case, I would be good with it being true that celebrity book clubs sell books if they are helping expose a really large audience of readers to books that that the readers might not otherwise discover. Now, we have not yet like seen a moment where I think that that's the case. Most of the books that these celebrities are amplifying are books that also have huge marketing campaigns around them. But like if Reese Witherspoon picked a book from
$2 Radio
or Grey Wolf Press or something, and then it sold 2 million copies, I would be delighted. So yeah, I think I would be okay with it. I don't really care if it's true or not. I would like to know if it's true or not. Yeah. But if it is the case that celebrity book clubs sell books, like I'd like to know. And then maybe that also is feedback to the celebrities running those book clubs. Like this is actually having a measurable impact. So you have some responsibility here to think about what you're doing.
You could be a benevolent influencer, so to speak. Right. You know, in that kind of a way. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do wonder if celebrities being a thing about recommending books actually sells more books in total or just distributes them differently. And I'm not sure about that, right?
Yeah, like,
were the people going to buy X number of books anyway, and it's just rerouting those book purchases, or does the actual does the tide of book purchasing go up in a meaningful way? I don't remember. We weren't around doing this enough in the heyday of Oprah to know. Were the quarters of Oprah in her heyday selling more books in average than the year before?
Right? That is a great question. I would love that information. My guess would be, like, in general, that this just shifts the book buying attention to the celebrity ones, but rather than raising the tide overall.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know. Whimsy of the year.
Oh man, this is my favorite story. And I should have pulled up the link so I could have the guy's full name, but we had this story way back in early 2019 about a man, I think in or near Knoxville, Tennessee, who had retired. He had a lot of money, and the thing he was doing with his money was building an ancient lore theme park about a group of people or creatures called Nobbins. And it was like across the street from the Walmart.
Incredible stuff.
And we were like, how is this not going to be copyright infringement? Because this sounds an awful lot like Middle Earth. And then he had to put it on hold for other reasons. But I just wish to salute this man's deep whimsy of like, I am old and rich and this is the thing I'm going to do. Now, like, you could make more impact in the world if you spent that money doing other things, but the whimsy of and like it's very gutsy, I think, to be like, I'm just gonna rip off Lord of the Rings basically, and we're gonna call the hobbits Nobbins.
Gutsy, malfeasant, criminal. You know, you could go a couple different ways with that.
It's bold.
Bold or is it obtuse? It's hard to know the difference sometimes.
Maybe both.
Yeah, maybe both.
Boldly
maybe
obtuse, both. Obtusely bold.
It was certainly the most something story of the year. I find myself looking at it and making and feeling like it's some sort of Rorschach test.
Yeah, I don't know what
like,
my face is
what you react
to.
It says something about you, but I don't know what exactly.
Yeah, I can't really be appalled by it because it's also not like the Tolkien estate needs more money.
No.
But then, you know, principles and copyright matter, whatever. Like, I think this is something that actually, it didn't happen, but it's a relatively harmless concept. I just was delighted that we got to talk about it. And
I do too. I also like that ancient lore is different than just lore. Like, isn't all lore ancient? Is it like not modern lore? I guess that's an urban myth.
Well, I guess you could just it could be old without being ancient. Like, there's old lore, right? Without ancient lore.
I feel like ancient is somehow implied in lore. Mm. Anyway, there was something really both innocent and avaricious about this. That combination makes it hard to understand.
It's very confusing. I do think you're right about the Rorschach thing. Like, I don't know what my face is supposed to do right. about this story. Am I supposed to, like, cheer him on? Am I supposed to be mad about it? I kind of just want to go. Like, I wish it existed so I could go see what a Nobbin looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a fun one.
Heroes of the Year. This is a corporate award to all the body of librarians and elected officials who fought book challenges. There's a bunch of you out there, too many to name. That is, in the book world of books and reading, the least glamorous and maybe the most important work being done out there. And so shout out to all of you. Before we get to In Memoriam, I had another trend that's a story kind of made up of a whole bunch of different stories. The adaptation Gold Rush continues, and I think we may have hit peak around the time of the billion with a B dollars, speaking of Lord of the Rings and Middle Earth. We saw the end of Game of Thrones on HBO this year. We see Watchmen. We saw His Dark Materials launch. We are having the Foundation series and a whole bunch of others, and the crown jewel in that adaptation Gold Rush is still to come, and that's the Amazon prequel story. I just saw today that someone was cast as young Galadriel, which is, I think, the first time we've actually had a name associated with one of the characters there. So I don't know that any one of those stood out enough, but together, the adaptation Gold Rush is certainly one of the stories of 2019. Maybe the most peak story, the most extra story in books and reading is everything's being adapted.
Yeah, I thought about putting something related to adaptations on the agenda because we've talked for a couple of years about, like, okay, this is as many adaptations as we can possibly handle.
We've been wrong. Right? We've sold it short and we've lost our shirts a million times selling adaptations short.
We have. I think it's just going to continue until, like, for as long as the streaming thing is expanding, as long as the streaming universe is expanding, this adaptation trend is going to continue. And when the streaming universe starts to contract, which I think it has to inevitably do, I think we'll see a slowdown then. But which it does feel like most of the big properties have been snatched up. So where it goes from here is going to be really interesting.
Yeah. Let's do a break. And we're going to talk about a best of our rest, our favorite non-book things from the year. But let's do a sponsor. Okay, how do you want to do this? Our categories don't correlate. Well, there's TV, food, which I was uncomfortable with the minute I saw personal colon. I was like, I'm not going to look directly at it.
It's just like miscellaneous. It's miscellaneous.
Uh-huh. Okay, sure.
Usually we just bounce back and forth. But
you go first then.
Okay.
You go first.
All right, where am I going to start? This is not a thing that was new this year, but a thing that it was new to me is a podcast called Dissect that does close readings and deep dives into music. Mm. And they did an 8-episode bonus season entirely about the miseducation of Lauryn Hill.
Oh, come on. That for you, that's not even catnip.
I know.
That's like catnip laced with, I don't know, Godiva chocolate dipped and fried.
It was the most perfect cultural experience that I had this year. Each episode was about one or two of the songs, and they would go literally like line by line of the lyrics and be like, and this is a reference to, and Lauryn Hill is perfect for this because there's like history and biblical references, and then this is a thing from this other song, and like there's just so much packed in that having someone dissect like what each little line of the rap meant, and that this is a reference to this thing that was happening in her cultural life. And this, like the hook in this song, is a cover of this Wu-Tang Clan song that was a cover of the Barbra Streisand version, which was a cover of like the Diana Ross original. Yeah, like it was right. There was just some really mind-blowing, fascinating stuff about the music history too, and all of the different musical influences that she brought in. And then you keep remembering over and over that she was 21 when she wrote the thing, when she wrote that album. It was just incredible. It was a really great listening experience. And I learned so much. That's been one of my favorite albums for the 20 something years that it's been out. And it made going back into that album really rich. I really loved it.
I'm just going to bounce around. Speaking of the deep fried catnip for yourself, and you went here with me.
I did.
In Portland. To Matt's Barbecue Tacos, that's on Hawthorne Street here in Southeast Portland, not too far from my house. Don't be creepy. It's barbecue and tacos, and they're fantastic. My favorite new to me thing to eat this year. If you happen to find yourself in Portland, go look for Matt's Barbecue Tacos. They're great. I've been several times. I think about them way more than I should. I loved them. There you go. That's my favorite food thing of the year.
My favorite.
It's tough because people can't get it.
It's
but
true.
What am I going to do?
I know. I'm still thinking about the chocolate babka you talked about last year.
Oh, which I've had twice this year, just by the way.
My favorite food thing was a cookbook called Sister Pie by Lisa Ludwinski, who owns a bakery also called Sister Pie in Detroit. My summer project this year was to... Like, I'm a good cook and I've been intimidated by baking, and biscuits and pie are like the things I was the most scared of, especially as a Southern cook. So my summer project was like, I'm going to learn like to perfect buttermilk biscuits, and I want to get over this fear of making my own pie dough. And my friend Josh Christie at Print Bookstore in Portland, Maine, is an avid baker, and he recommended Sister Pie to me as a great cookbook for the basics, but also because there's something like interesting or different about most of the pie flavors. So like the apple pie is basically a classic apple pie, but there's a little gouda in the dough and a little sage in the filling. So it's like just a little interesting and savory. So I spent my summer and now well into the fall and winter working on biscuits from, I'm using Allison Roman's buttermilk biscuit recipe from Dining In, and working on pie. And I have cooked more than half of the pies in the Sister Pie cookbook. They're organized seasonally. So you have spring and summer pies and fall and winter pies. And then there are year-round pies. And I've dipped into some of those. There are cookie recipes. They also do creative salads and like some breakfast recipes. It's just a great cookbook. And one of the rare cookbooks in which the people in the photos and like the hands that you see doing the baking are not all white people. People of color are still super underrepresented in the world of cookbooks. And it was very cool to pick up a cookbook and get to see the people who work at Sister Pie and get to learn great techniques. And I am now no longer afraid of making my own pie dough.
Speaking of food, let's go back to, so one of my New Year's resolutions that I did, by the way, hooray me, to read 100 books, watch 100 movies, and listen to 100 new to me albums. Let me give you a couple picks from that project, books we've talked about before. On the movies front, I think my favorite was a 2011 documentary called Hero Dreams of Sushi about a master sushi, it's a documentary about a master sushi maker in Tokyo, Japan, who's been doing it his whole life. And my pitch is, what if sushi, but your whole life? And there's something about sushi that lends itself to a certain almost cult-like...
like obsessive
search for
reverence.
Purity, yeah. Right? Like the as close to the raw ingredients served at exactly the right time and exactly the right way and exactly the right person, that is a pursuit of perfection that is both illusory and intoxicating. And I don't even like sushi, frankly. But I found this documentary to be really interesting, of committing yourself to one thing and really only caring about that thing. And on the whole, the documentary is celebratory. But there are tinges of darkness you can see around the edges of what it costs to do something like that. And I thought it was really good. And it scratches a couple of my itches. One is armchair travel. Like, I'm interested in other places, but going there is almost beside the point for me. I am very interested in food as a gateway to learning about other cultures and ideas and histories and habits of mind and belief systems. And this was really intriguing. entree there. And it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful kind of thing. And the kind of thing that I wouldn't have watched if I wasn't trying to sort of put in reps, you know, like if I'm just watching what a Avengers Endgame and Star Wars, I'd have enjoyed that. But I wouldn't have had this experience. So that's my favorite there. I also really liked 45 Years, which is a film that's a domestic drama that actually ends up playing like a thriller and you don't see it coming. It came out about 8 years ago, or no, 2013. It's a British film. I don't think you can get it anywhere. I had to get it through my library in physical CD form like an animal. But it really snuck up on me, and it was fantastic. And I think, actually, Rebecca, you would like it. As someone who, the 45 years represents the 45 years this couple is married.
Sold.
And the over the course of the couple weeks of them planning for their anniversary party, someone discovers there's a secret.
Ooh.
And it's very understated. It's not like a Gone Girl type of thing. But in a way, it's even more devastating because it's not flashy. So that's, I won't spoil it there. And then Michelle and I think we had the most surprising fun watching Booksmart at home together one night. It just was fun. The kind of movie, you know, it's about smart, nerdy girls in their last weekend of high school and, you know, blowing it out while they have a time before going off to Stanford. And they realize that they maybe kept too many bullets in their holsters and trying to be smart and accomplished and maybe missed out and trying to catch up all at once. And I think Michelle and I both laughed simultaneously the most at this movie as any movie we watched this year. So that kind of under the radar, I think, on the whole this year. So those are my three movie picks. And real quickly, just one music. And music is so subjective. I find that my own taste is so divergent than most people I know that it's even hard to recommend. But The Dip, it's a group out of Seattle. They're sort of a neo-funk soul band. The Dip Delivers is their newest EP. You can find it on Spotify. If you like it, great. If not, also fine, but that was my favorite discovery in music of 2019.
Yeah, I got a preview of that pick when you were recapping some of your best discoveries from this Listen to 100 Albums project, and I've been listening to The Dip. We have a lot of overlap in our
You like
musical.
The Dip?
I do. Yeah. Okay. It's great. And that
I thought you would.
That album by The War and the Treaty that you recommended as well.
Yes.
That's been one of my favorites for a couple of years. Cosign on Booksmart. I also really loved it. I feel like it's like super bad, but smart and with like updated and with girls. I really dug it. On the TV front, I watched a lot of TV this year. I got into Succession like everybody did, but you don't
need that's like picking oxygen.
Right. Like you don't need to, you don't need me to tell you how good Succession is. I also really loved, and I haven't seen nearly as much discussion about it, on Becoming a God in Central Florida, which is on Showtime starring Kirsten Dunst and, what's his name? One of the very tall, handsome men who was on the Sookie Stackhouse HBO show and also on Big Little Lies. It's a Swedish last name.
I have no idea. Skarsgård?
Yes, Alexander Skarsgård. Thank you. It's set in the like late 80s, early 90s around Orlando. And Skarsgård is desperate to get out of his insurance job. And he gets like sucked into an MLM like scheme that's basically Amway. And Kirsten Dunst is his very frustrated, sassy wife. Something happens to him in the first episode and she ends up trying to like take over his attempt at an Amway empire, basically. And it is absurd and weird. And so like, it's the perfect thing for Kirsten Dunst. Like she gets to sneer at people and be sarcastic and
use her resting dunce face, like whatever that thing she has is. Yeah,
it is perfect. It's like the essence of Kirsten Dunst. And it's just a delightful skewering and satire of multi-level marketing and those like almost religious promises that MLMs make to people about the personal satisfaction and the success that they're going to have. And then, you know, the more she gets into it, the more of like the gross underbelly of the situation she discovers. And you also get to spend time on screen with the guy who created this whole system and is willing to sell you 900 audio tapes to listen to in your car and be inspired by. Is also a really great breakthrough performance by a young actor who plays the guy who was Skarsgård's upline, who recruited him into, it's called FAM in the show.
His upline? Is that like your handler?
Your upline is the person who recruited you into the MLM and gets to take a gets a take of your stuff, and then anybody that you recruit is your downline.
Wow. I am nervous about any enterprise that has such maturely developed taxonomies.
If you are deeply suspicious and filled with side eye about multi-level marketing things, you will find it very satisfying. And it's just, it's bonkers. Like, there are just some truly bonkers things that happen in it that made it really fun to watch. And I am currently watching the HBO adaptation of Mrs. Fletcher by Tom Perata, which stars Katherine Hahn. And it's, this is definitely way past the O'Neill raunchiness on screen comfort level.
Okay, fair. Thank you.
But it extends the world of the story. It's about a woman in her 40s whose son goes off to college. She's an empty nester, and she is discovering herself in new ways. In the book, the son gets kind of lost. In the show, you see him. He's like a big man on campus. He's a real jerk in high school. He goes off to college, and we get to spend some time with him, watching him figure out like how to navigate the 2019 world of people having expectations about how woke you will be when you're like a really privileged white guy who's never been exposed to that concept before. So he's learning some uncomfortable experiences. Every time I watch it, Bob is like, I just feel so uncomfortable, but this is really funny. And I feel like that's a good encapsulation. It's a great performance from Katherine Hahn.
Let's get out on this because it's sort of a tease for what we're going to do in the future. I'm holding the season finale of Watchmen in the hands of my soul like a bird, because I don't want it to be over. Like, I DM'd you, or I texted you. I don't remember.
You texted me.
I may have resorted to texting, which for me is essentially like running like around on the rooftops. Mm-hmm. And episode 7 of Watchmen is one of my favorite hours of TV, and I was completely entranced, and I don't care if it's recency bias. But we're going to be talking about Watchmen. Rebecca, you just finished recently reading the graphic novel for the first time.
I did.
In anticipation of watching the rest. Give me your 90-second reaction to the graphic novel. Was it all that in a bag of chips? Was it just the chips? Was it nothing? What was your experience?
It was so interesting doing it, having watched the first episode of the HBO series. And like, I had a bunch of questions that I was like, is the book going to answer those or not? And it didn't really, but it made me intrigued. I was so drawn in by like the play with time and all the different stories that lay over each other, like the amount of attention that was required for it. And then in the last couple of issues, the way that everything was knit together. And it did leave me ultimately being like, okay, I kind of can see how this might jump forward into the show. I'm really, really glad that I did it. You and a couple friends recommended to me, like, read the book before you get into the show. It's going to make it richer. And I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. A few episodes in, it's not clear what the relationship, I don't think it wasn't clear for me. Let's put it that way. What the relationship was to the TV show to the original graphic novel series. I guess now graphic novel is a series originally, but in the fullness of time, it actually is just a sequel with a bunch of new characters. Like, everything that happens in the graphic novel has happened in the world of the TV show. So it's not really a spoiler. Just, I think it reaffirms that to squeeze all the juice out of the lemon that is the TV show, spending a couple hours reading the graphic novel, I think, is well worth the investment. That's my take on the situation. Yeah. So cool. We're going to talk about Watchmen, the series, when we are back in January. So consider that a tease of our favorite of 2019 going to something we're covering in 2020. Rebecca, it's been a great year.
Yeah.
There'll be probably more book news next year, I'm guessing.
I'm thinking so.
Yeah. Any predictions?
Oh, no. I'm tired, Jeff. I'm not ready for predictions yet.
Yeah, me neither. We'll talk to you guys later.
Have a good one.